session number 27210, reel 1.
Lord Healy, thank you very much indeed for agreeing to contribute to the Imperial War Museum Sound Archive. This is very much appreciated. Could we start, please, with you telling me your full name, your date of birth, and where you were born, please?
Yes, my full name is Dennis Winston Healy. My father was a lover of lost causes, and I was born in 1917 at Mottingham in Kent when Winston was in the doghouse over the Dardanelles. And so, as I say, he called me Winston as my second name.
Can you tell me something about your father and your mother and your childhood?
Yes, my mother was a lustrous young woman, very reminiscent to me of Anne Veronica. She even had a trial marriage with my father and her mother in the Isle of Man, and her mother wouldn't talk to her for a month afterwards. And he was actually very romantic and mainly interested in literature, but he got a degree in civil engineering and became a teacher at technical colleges, and then when I was five he became head of the technical college in Keighley in Yorkshire. So we moved up there, and that was really where I was brought up in Yorkshire and went to school at Bradford, as you know.
And so really you regard Yorkshire, notwithstanding you are born in Kent, you regard Yorkshire as your home county?
Absolutely. I regard myself as Yorkshire Irish, like the Brontes. And William Yeats, you know, his descendants came from Yorkshire.
Yes, of course. Can you tell me something about your school days, if you would?
Well, I enjoyed my school days very much indeed. my main interest, I did classics, Latin and Greek, and finally got a scholarship to Balliol at Oxford. But my main interest really was in literature and painting. And I used to go during the break, as we called it, playtime, over to the church bookhouse across the road to buy postcards of paintings by the Impressionists. I was very keen on Van Gogh and Gauguin, Monet and people like that. And we also had the good luck of going to very cheap seats to listen to the Halle Orchestra in Bradford, conducted by Hamilton Harty in those days, but occasionally by John Bobbitt Ollie.
Fascinating. Mm. Where was the Halle based? Was it?
Halle was based in Manchester, I think.
Was it?
But we also had some very interesting people in Bradford whom I got to know. There was a painter called Sitchell, Humbert Wolfe. I always remember him talking at our prize day once, and I read his poetry thereafter. And Rothenstein, of course, was at Bradford Grammar School too, the painter, and wrote some fascinating memoirs.
Was there any history of academic and scholastic ability in your family?
Well, my father's, he was the son of an Irish immigrant into Britain who lived in a house I photographed. Was in a cottage at Kilty Clocher, just across in County Leitrim, what is now the border. And it was a whitewashed stone cottage with a straw roof, no windows, only three doors, and no chimney, because they couldn't afford fires in those days. And he's supposed, but I've never been able to confirm that, to have been a Fenian as a very young man before he came to England. But they went to Todmorden, which is where my father was brought up, which is a dangerous border town on the border between Yorkshire and Lancashire. And I used to go over there quite a lot to meet my Auntie Maggie. And but he, as I say, did well, and he taught at the London Poly for a time, and then he started the Technical College in Keighley in Yorkshire.
So the answer, in a way, is yes, in a particular degree.
I'm always embarrassed when I'm described in Yorkshire as Yorkshire born and bred, because I was bred in Yorkshire, but I was born in Mottingham in Kent, and we lived on a little Hutment estate, rather like Soweto now, where one of the other little boys was a chap I never met at the time, though I met a lot later, called Frankie Howard, the comedian. Titty ye not.
Yes, yes. The late Frankie Howard. Can you tell me something about Oxford? First, was it a surprise to you and your family that you won a scholarship, I think?
Yes, that's right.
Did that come as a surprise?
Well, it was difficult to get a scholarship to Oxford from Yorkshire, and especially to a college like Balliol. Most Yorkshire boys who were bright tended to get what were called Hastings scholarships to Queen's College at Oxford. But I got this to Balliol, and I wanted to do classics, and Balliol had enormous influence on me. I had very good teachers, but the real influence was from Sandy Lindsay, Alexander Lindsay, who was the master of Balliol at the time, and was one of the very few socialist heads of college, I think almost the only one at the time, and stood as a Popular Front candidate in the Oxford by-election in 1938 against the Munich Agreement. And both Ted Heath, who was a Conservative then also, who was chairman of the JCR, the Junior Common Room, and I was its secretary, we both campaigned for Sandy, but he lost, unfortunately.
Was this the election that Quentin Hogg stood?
Yes, that's right. Hogg was the appeasement candidate, something I think he was rather ashamed of in later life, because I got to know him very well, and I know still his daughter Sarah very well.
Yes. Can you just tell me something about the atmosphere of Oxford at that time in this?
Well, I think, first of all, Balliol itself was very, very much an intellectuals' college. And if you were a scholarship boy, you know, you'd really fail if you didn't get a first-class degree, and I got a double first because I took honor mods, which is Latin and Greek, and then philosophy and ancient history. And philosophy, I think, had a great influence on me, the philosophy. And also, to be honest, I think Thucydides can teach you as much about politics in the modern world as anything you can read anywhere. I also started the New Oxford Art Society while I was there, because there was no art club of any sort at Oxford, and arranged one of the first two surrealist exhibitions in Britain with help from George Messens and Penrose, whose son I met the other day at Chidding Rye. And I also organised an exhibition of Picasso's etchings at the time of when he painted Guernica, and I could have bought one for £5. What a fool I was, but £5 was a million to me in those days.
Of course, of course.
And we also had at Balliol, Ted Heath was the organ scholar, paying astonishing voluntaries on his ruined organ, as once said, and we had a very good pianist called George Malcolm, who became the leading harpsichord player in Britain when he grew up.
Can I just ask, I'm going to come back to Oxford again in a moment with another question, but can I just ask, 10 years later in 1945, you were seen as quite a radical. Were you radical then?
Oh yes, I joined the Communist Party for 2 years.
That was an anti-fascist movement, wasn't it?
Absolutely, and it was in the Popular Front period when, as I say, the master of Balliol stood as the Popular Front candidate, and the policy of the Communist Party was slightly to the right of the Liberal Party in those days, because it was trying to form Popular Fronts, as you know, all over Europe, in France, Italy and Germany.
But not with much success?
Well, it was very successful in Italy because it had a very good leader there who was not too obedient to the orders of Moscow. But it didn't do anything like as well in France. And in Germany it really got nowhere because, of course, the Germans were very anti-Soviet.
Of course. coming back to my Oxford question again then, which I'm trying to get a feel of what it was like there, and I often ask people of your age, did you get the... I mean, you probably did because you were a member of the Communist Party because you were anti-fascist, but was there a general feeling that this terrible catastrophe was coming?
Oh, absolutely. It was a general feeling.
It was.
Yes, it was. And I think that's why so many people... I mean, in those days, I think the total student population was only 4,500, and 1,500 joined the Labour Club, of whom 250 joined the Communist Party, including people like John Biggs Davison, who later became chairman of the Tory Monday Club.
The Monday Club.
And Iris Murdoch, who was a friend of mine at Oxford.
Oh, she was a contemporary of yours?
Yes. Well, she was 2 years behind me.
And she was at Balliol?
No. They didn't have women in
of
those days. No. She was, I think, at Somerville.
I apologise for that.
Yes. I'm not quite sure. I think she was at Somerville, yes.
Yes. Which again, of course, was all women. All the colleges were either all men.
Absolutely.
Or women.
There were no bisexual colleges in those days. There were only bisexual lecturers.
The war started in 39, but you took your finals in 40?
That's right. I volunteered the day the war broke out. I rang up Balliol and said I wanted to volunteer. And then I hung around for weeks in the autumn of 39, and they didn't call me up. And then I was told I should go back to Oxford and take my degree, and I'd missed the whole of the Michaelmas term, but I took my degree and got a double first in the following summer. And then I joined the Home Guard to protect Ilkley Moor from attacks by German paratroopers, of which there were none, although we did see bombing at Bradford from where I was.
Did you?
And then I was actually called up in September, and I had I did the whole war then until the end of 1945, and I ruptured myself on my field training college course at UNIAC barracks at Harrogate, and after the operation was sent to the Woolwich Arsenal, the barracks there, where we were subject to air raids all the time. And then I was posted to replace a drunken bombardier as a railway checker at Swindon Station, which was an odd job because I had to count all the numbers of service men and women getting on every train, off every train, and off and on every train when they went out to get a drink at the bar. And of course I made up the off and on, and I made up those getting on, and I used to go to the ticket collector for those getting off, and I discovered after 3 weeks he made up his figures too. So I had a lifelong distrust of statistics after that, which served me well when I became Chancellor.
Can I take you back, just if I may, to when you were called up and you go to UNIAC barracks?
Yeah.
What was the calibre and mix and social class and type of your fellow conscripts, I suppose, in one sense one must call you?
Well, no, we were volunteers.
You were still volunteers?
Yeah, I don't think they introduced conscription until the end of the fall of France, did they?
I don't know.
I'm not quite sure, but no, we were all volunteers.
So you were still a volunteer?
Yes, and they were an extraordinary mix. a lot of working class boys. One, for example, at the first lecture we had, didn't seem to understand what was happening, and finally admitted he couldn't write. But we had public school boys, one of whom became a lifelong friend, Hugh Sebag Montefiore, who was...
We got to Hugh Sebag Montefiore.
Yes, that's right. UNIAC barracks.
Yes.
That's right. And...
describing the great mix that you had of your fellow volunteers.
Oh, yes. I mean, I always remember, when you had a route march, you had 5 minutes rest in a ditch before you had your next hour, I noticed that my friend Billy from another Yorkshire town was limping very badly, and I said, hey, Billy, your boots are two sizes too small. He said, I know, Dennis. I said, well, all right, when we get back to the barracks, I'll take it at quartermaster, get you a proper pay. He said, for Christ's sake, Dennis, don't do that. I said, why not? He said, well, you know, Uniacke Barracks, it's 5 miles from nearest lass and 10 miles from nearest pub, and taking these bloody boots off is the only pleasure I get in life.
When, can you just quickly describe the sort of training that you were given? Because this must have been an early example of comprehensive education with a complete mix.
There was a little bit of that, which of course I thought of other things while they were doing that. But we had a great deal of physical training, which did me the world of good. And also we we had drill, which, in fact, I found quite useful, because it teaches you to do some things automatically, so you can concentrate your mind on other things entirely. And oddly enough, I quite enjoyed my time, before I became an officer. But before long, they sent me to an officer's training course at Scarborough, where I met a handsome young actor, Nigel Patrick, who did very well in films later on. But as I say, I went into movement control because I'd ruptured myself, and I found it terribly boring working at railway stations in Yorkshire. So I volunteered for combined ops and trained in combined operations, assault landings, in Troon and Greenock.
May I just interrupt you and ask you, how quickly were you identified, if you like, almost from day one as being a potential candidate for OCTU, or did it take some time, or did you have to apply?
Well, I didn't have to apply. No, I was asked if I would do it, so they must have identified me. But, you know, if you had a double first, that you obviously, unless you were Weasley or frightened, you were obvious officer caliber.
Yes, yes. And how did you alight, or was it alighted upon you, movement control? How did you end up?
I found that itself very boring, which is why I volunteered for combined ops training.
So the army decided it wanted you to be a movement control officer.
That's right. So I did my training at Troon in Scotland and saw an aircraft sunk by a mine which had been dropped the night before, an aircraft carrier sunk by a mine, and did a street fighting course at Greenock, in which you went into a house and a chamber pot full of blood went over your head, supposed to make you used to that sort of thing. But my mother thought I was much more mature when I came back from the field training course. And then, as I say, I...
What effect did seeing the aircraft carrier sink have upon you? You were on the golf course and it sank?
I was on the golf course at Troon. We were doing actually combined ops training because it's on the edge of the sea. It was extraordinary because they were a few miles away, so you couldn't see very easily what was happening, but I just saw the thing go underwater. It was extraordinary.
Now, in your memoir, you refer to it as going down with all hands.
Yes, I think it did.
It did. Mm. They must have sunk very quickly.
Very, very. It did, within a minute or two.
And this great tragedy unfolding before you. What I'm interested in is, in your memoir, you cover this in three sentences or two sentences. But it must have had an effect upon you, or did it not? Or did you just...
Not very much. No, I don't think so. I knew war is a thing, and I'd been in the Blitz in London. And you expect tragedies like that to occur. But I really enjoyed my field training, my combined ops training. And as you know, I was AMLO, Assistant Military Landing Officer, for the landing at Olon at the beginning. Then came back to England because I had got pneumonia, and then I was sent out again to Tunisia, to Algeria, That's right, just outside Alger.
Let's try and take it in a sort of linear sense. You did. You got out of movement control. You volunteered for combined ops.
That's right.
And
but I was on what was called the movement side of it, which was assistant military landing officer, which was not a beachmaster. Beachmaster is a naval officer whose job is to get landing craft onto the beach. My job was to get the soldiers
off the beach.
So that I had to spend the whole time of the landing on the beach itself, which was quite dangerous because you were targeted by dive bombers and ordnance bombers, of course, as well. And the landing I did in Calabria, Porto Santa Venere, we were also mortared mercilessly from the mountains just above.
Well, we'll come to that. How well did you feel that your training prepared you for the reality when you first embarked on it, looking back in retrospect?
Well, the basic thing about the training is, first of all, you learn discipline, which is very important, self-discipline as well as, you know, obeying orders. I think, as I say, the drill you learn means you can do some things automatically and concentrate your mind on the things which need thinking about. But, of course, there's no substitute for reality, and I learned a great deal more from the first landing, or at least the post-landing I did in Calabria, than from all the training I'd done previously. And I learned two things, really, from my wartime career. One was that we all depend on one another. You depend on all your comrades in the same unit and in other units, in the artillery, and on other services like the Air Force and the Navy. So interdependence was one thing which had a big influence on my political thinking, and also the importance of planning every operation carefully, but knowing that the plan is bound to go wrong at some stage, and then you've got to be very quick on your feet.
Yes. I'm going to have a short digression here and ask you how this interdependency which you learned, how did that manifest itself in your subsequent political career?
Well, when I was at defence, of course, it was just a repetition in a sense of my wartime experiences, Navy, Army and Air Force depending on one another, officers depending on one another, you know, people in different parts of the same service, artillery. Infantrymen depend on the artillery, and then for landings you need aircraft carriers, but they need protection by submarines and so on.
Oh, I see. I thought that you were going to apply a specific lesson learnt within your military career into in a wider sense.
Well, yes, I did, because I learned later on in my political career that, you know, you depend on your trade union supporters, on your ordinary supporters, and of course when you're Chancellor you depend on people over whom you have no control. In defence, you control the people on whom you depend in the services and in the arms factories, but in the Treasury you depend on producers all over the country and sometimes abroad, and consumers who are more abroad than in Britain. So in a way my army training was intellectually very helpful to my later political life.
Thank you. Would you like to take me through in as much detail as you wish from the point when you leave England, which I think is from your memoir, August 42-ish or something
like
that?
Yeah, the first landing, which I did at Alger for the capture of Baron.
This was
A-R-Z-E-U. That particular one was completely unopposed, and we had total security. And
you mean the Vichy French didn't know you were coming?
No. And I don't think people are used to, the enemy, the Actually, we were there. The opposition was not German. It was the French collaborators, and we had total security, and the landing was a piece of cake. But then I was sent back to Britain for a landing in Spanish Morocco, which never took place, and so I left again in November 1942 for the landing in for the North African campaign, and we landed in Algiers and spent a week or so at a camp above Algiers, Bouzareya, and then went up the coast, Guelma, Bougie, Boulogne, Tunis, and we'd been with 8th Army, and it was a very successful, rapid campaign. We did it in 3 days from Algiers to Tunis, and we were then put into 8th Army, and I always remember being drawn up on the beach at Hammamet on a hot June day, and Monty, vain as ever, wearing his foulard, said, gentlemen, I know you'll all be very proud to be joining the 8th Army, and the temperature dropped below zero, because he hadn't a clue, of course, that we'd been involved.
Now that would be a weakness on his on one of his staff officers not telling him who he was going to talk to.
Might be, or maybe just his typical vanity. And I didn't do the assault landing, because we landed 3 days after the landing in Sicily. We landed at Avila, and then we had a very bloody landing.
Lord Healy, before we get to that, I'd just like to ask you, what you landed in North Africa in November.
Yes.
42. This is your second visit to the North African.
That's right, yes.
Because you've been there in August.
But
whatever,
only
September,
for a couple of days.
A few days. What were your tasks and what did you do in that period between November 42 and when you had this interesting speech from Montgomery in June 43?
Well, I did very little. I mean, I was still in movement control, but I was waiting for combined ops. That was the thing I was really keen on. And I'd practically very little to do except, frankly, drive up in my Jeep, drive up the coast. And I mean, I even had time, as I think I wrote in my book, to do some painting. But once the landing in Italy took place, that was a very bloody one with 221 Brigade under Roy Urquhart. It was very different once we got to Italy, because we were always liable to be attacked from the air.
Now, before you get to Italy, the mainland proper, did you go to Sicily?
Yeah, I said so. Landed at Avila.
I'm sorry.
In Sicily. We landed 3 days after the main invasion, though.
Right.
Because I'd originally been ordered back to Tripoli to take part as beachmaster or military landing officer for the landing at Salerno. But then they told me to go and join 231 Brigade instead for the landing in Calabria, and which was lucky because my successor, who was a great friend, Bill Groom, with the Salerno landing, was killed on the landing because there the security was appalling. The Germans knew exactly when and where we were going to land and were ready to get us.
And then you moved on to your first serious opposed landing in
Porto Santa Bene, yes.
Yes.
But, I mean, it was very interesting because my job was to see that the boats were properly loaded, and I used to do little paper cutouts of the rectangles, the right size, so I managed to get ambulances on, although they didn't think they would have room for them. Which was very fortunate because it was a very bloody opposed landing, and the Germans were able to mortar us from the hills above, and we couldn't possibly see where they were. All the thing went wrong, and later on, Ming Campbell, who was the son-in-law you know, the Liberal leader, son-in-law of Roy Urquhart, told me that Urquhart said my account was absolutely accurate.
How long were you stuck on that beach for?
Oh, not very long. I mean, really a day and a night. And then the Germans moved on. You see, they were moving north from Sicily. And this was what we called in those days a seaborne hook, which was landing behind the enemy lines to try to prevent their movement, which was like the biggest one we did, which was a failure from that point of view, with Anzio, yes.
So the Germans moved from their, what one could describe as pole position overlooking the beaches.
Yes.
Because there had been a landing behind them, and they knew that if they didn't move, they'd be cut off. Was that the case?
Yes, and also because they wanted to get out as fast as possible and move north. That's what they were told to do, so that they could prevent us taking Rome and Naples. But of course, they failed in that.
Well, yes, they did. Lord Healy, if you would then, we have this supposed landing. What exactly were your tasks then when you were actually on the beach?
My thing was, first of all, make sure that they swept the mine, the engineer, the sappers, swept the mines and made a path which we had to put white tapes by the side of, over which the tanks and lorries could go, and of course we had to put metal carpets, as it were, over the beach so that they could get across it, because we'd had a terrible experience earlier, which I never understand how they could have been so idiotic.